Welcome again, everybody. I'm the lead pastor here. I want to welcome everybody in the room and also everybody on Zoom. Thanks so much for joining us. And today we're going to wrap up a series we've been in for the last few weeks called God is Not Distant. And really what we're exploring there is the fact that God actually sometimes does feel distant. You know, I know for me, I can talk myself into atheism at least a couple of times before lunch, you know, on most days. We have our doubts, right? We have those doubts. Some of those are intellectual doubts. Some of them are experiential doubts where we just don't feel God's presence. So we're exploring that whole topic and ways that we can perhaps experience God more fully, more deeply, more really in everyday life. So we've explored a different topic each week over the last few weeks. Today, we're going to look at nature and explore experiencing God through nature. And nature's a wonderful thing, a beautiful thing. I'm going to be talking about that a little bit. A few disclaimers to start off with, though. Firstly, I'm not saying nature is the only way to experience God or the best way to experience God. We've been hearing all through this series about some great ways to experience God that you know, were certainly not exhaustive. There's all kinds of ways of experiencing God. I think nature's a really good one, though. I'm not saying either that we all have to be nature freaks, tree huggers, whatever you want to call it. but at the same time, whether we like it or not, we all are all part of nature, right? We all belong to nature, but nature belongs to us. I'm also, this is perhaps my biggest disclaimer, I want to say I am not an expert. I'm going to be talking a little bit about nature, but I am definitely not an expert. Give you an illustration of that. You know, I love the outdoors and I love nature and I love being connected to nature. A few years ago, I did a primitive skills fire by friction course. Has anybody ever done that? Or a workshop. There's a primitive skills group based in Greenbelt that do some really great classes. You want to check it out sometime. And I went with my youngest son, who was then, he was probably about 12. He was in middle school. And we show up and we felt pretty, you know, we know a fair bit about nature and being connected to nature. The course started off, or the workshop started off, walking around this forest and identifying trees whose wood would be good for certain tools in the fire making process. To make the fire, we would make a bow. You know, you'd get a stick from a certain kind of tree, then you'd peel bark from another tree and make it into twine, string it to the bow, and then you use a dowel and you'd sort of, you know, you get the action going there, and that's how you get the friction and the heat and eventually the fire, supposedly. So you know, we're walking around and we knew most of the trees that were being identified, and there was a group of about 10 of us probably, and there was a particular couple that showed up who I would describe them as really beautiful people. They looked really beautiful. They were dressed immaculately, but they did not look like outdoors people. I won't go any further than that, but they didn't really seem to blend in, with nature, that's for sure. They were just, you know, and they stood out in that sort of way. And I could tell, I don't know whether we actually verbalized it, but I think most of the group, including me and my son, were thinking like, oh, yeah, they're going to struggle out in the woods. You know, this is going to be problematic. I wonder how they're going to get on. Anyway, they sort of tiptoed around the woods and we did all the identification. And then it came to the fire making. And so we're trying to put the thing together and get the fire going. You know, there's probably about, let's say there's 10 or 15 people. There's probably 10 couples or singles that are trying to get this fire going. Somebody gets it going. And we're like, oh, my son and I were like, oh, man, we're trying harder. Then another person, then this couple, they get their fire going, right? This couple who we thought, oh, they're going to be lost in the woods, they get their fire going. We were the last people to get our fire going. In fact, we totally failed at it. And I had this bow and I was going as hard as I could, getting really frustrated, strained my shoulder, had to have physical therapy for about 4 weeks after that. And with all the pain, I would feel the shame of both not getting the fire going, but also the shame of being so judgmental, you know, of stereotyping people and actually thinking, oh, I'll be okay. So I am not an expert when it comes to nature. Come Armageddon, come the apocalypse, I'm going to be worse off than that couple, right? When it comes, you know, survival skills, all the rest of it. So an expert. And then final disclaimer is I'm not going to talk today about the threat to our environment, the threat to nature. You know, our planet is in a perilous condition. We'll save that for another time. But today I'm just going to talk about nature itself. And want to talk about it really from a very personal perspective. I think all of our experiences of God, by definition, are very personal. They're very subjective, right? So I'm going to share a little bit of my story around nature and see if you might be able to sort of relate to some of that. But my hope is that it'll help us all be inspired, at least, to connect more with nature as a way of experiencing something really beautiful and very, very real, very tangible, very concrete in that sense. And as I said, something very, very beautiful. So maybe we could put the first slide up, Greg. This is a picture of a woods, an ancient woodland near where I grew up in Kent, which is in the southeast of England. That places like Dover are there, you know, the White Cliffs of Dover. Anybody heard of that? The White Cliffs of Dover? Yep. Canterbury, you heard of Canterbury? That's all around there, where the Archbishop hangs out. But we're very blessed with some really ancient woodlands. And in these ancient woodlands, the bluebells grow about this time of year. So I would go out as a kid, as a very young kid, into these forests, and it was just overwhelmingly beautiful. I was painfully shy, still am in many respects, but, you know, as you grow up, you learn to fake it better than you. So, but I was painfully shy, so I actually felt nature as a bit of an escape, really. I felt more comfortable around animals and plants than I did with people, certainly with people that I didn't know. So it was kind of a retreat for me. And when I would walk through these woodlands or through the meadows in springtime, and I would go out to where the lambs would be born. You know, I lived in a bit of an armpit of a town, but it was surrounded by beautiful countryside, and still is. I'd feel this deep connection to something that I would probably have described as love. I felt love for what I was experiencing, and what I was experiencing was love. And I grew up in a religious family, so I was given a context to describe that or explain that, and that was God. So that made a lot of sense to me. Some people would describe that in other ways, in scientific ways. Neil deGrasse Tyson, for instance, puts it this way. Where's Neil when you need him? We are part of this universe. We are in this universe, but perhaps more important than both of those facts is that the universe is in us. So that we get from that, you know, just from a scientific perspective, we get this essence of oneness, that somehow we're all connected, that we're connected to whatever this reality is, and this reality is in us. We would describe that as followers of Jesus, of being one with God, just as Jesus talked about being one with God. So this, I would have these experiences of oneness, of connection, deep connection to God through being out there in nature. Now, so this sort of this passion, I can't even remember when it started, but it was just there. But then I started doing some things about it. I would just kind of read and study a little bit, even as a little kid. Honestly, became a little bit obsessive about some things. I have a tendency that way. So I'd try and, like, you know, learn names of plants and things like that. I when I was 9 years old, I went to a new school, because sometimes this can backfire on you. Went to a new school, and I you know, being shy, especially, first day there, I was just terrified, didn't say a word. And we had a session where we gathered around the teacher, and the teacher was holding up pictures of pretty common flowers and asking us, the students, what's this flower? And it would be, you know, pretty obvious ones. And I didn't say a word for the whole time, though. So the teacher, I'm sure, was trying to draw me out, held up a picture of a daffodil, which is, you know, very common flower here, but also in England, very common. This would have been about April, when a lot of daffodils were out. So he holds up the daffodil, and the trouble was, this daffodil was a certain cultivar. It had a yellow petals, but one of those ones with the orange trumpet in the middle. You know what I'm talking about? And there's all sorts of different cultivars of daffodils. So I'm looking at it thinking, well, it's a daffodil, but what kind of a daffodil is it? And I was trying to think of the name of that particular cultivar of daffodil. So I'm silent, because I'm not going to say daffodil. And then in the end, you could tell him, thinking, oh, poor guy doesn't know. And so he asks Jenny over here, Jenny, what is it? It's a daffodil. She goes, it's a daffodil. He goes, yes, it's a daffodil. Never mind, Matthew. And I'm thinking, wait a second. No, I mean, I know that's a daffodil. I'm thinking this. I didn't say it. I just remained silent. And he obviously thought I was a complete doofus. And because it was my first day, he was trying to assess which section of the class he should put me in. And I went into the bottom group of the class, you know, so sometimes it doesn't pay off to have a bit of knowledge about something, right? You know, so it sort of backfired on me a little bit. But I began sort of reading and studying. I got a subscription to this wildlife magazine, which was pretty incredible at the time. My family were not very well off at all. We didn't have comics, or we'd get hand-me-down comics and that kind of stuff. But We didn't have those kinds of things, but I was thinking about this the other day, actually, how my dad, we started buying copies of this wildlife magazine that would come out every week, and then eventually we got a subscription for it. So it was, and it was all about African wildlife. So I was reading about the Serengeti and just thinking, oh, this is just incredible. It's just amazing. And then when I was about 11 or 12, I discovered David Attenborough. You know, he's discovered a lot of things. I discovered him. I've got a picture of David Attenborough, I think. So there's David. It's his birthday this week, actually, on Wednesday. We're going out for a beer, hopefully. No, we won't do. He can't now because he's 98. He's going to be 98. Can you believe that? He'll be 98 this year. Lovely chap. This another picture of him. This is about what he was like when I encountered him first. He one of his books, so or TV shows. So I'd have probably been about 12 when this was on the TV. Had an accompanying book with it. It was the book Life on Earth. You may have seen this book, read this book. It's just a fantastic book. And I got this in the summer when I was going on an exchange visit to France. I think I've told this story before. I've told most of my stories before. That's the trouble. I've been here so long. I, you know, have to stop making some up. I got this book, and it was the summer, and I was going on an exchange visit with a student in France. You know, where the French student comes over and stays with you, and then you go over and stay with the French student. So I had this set up. I went over there. It was a family in Paris, and my student was a little bit older than me. He was a year, maybe 2 years older than me, and he was like very different to me. And he was his family was super liberal, and like he was allowed. I mean, he would have been about 13, I think, and he was allowed to smoke in his bedroom. I'm like, really? That's incredible. Anyway, so we went while I was there, the family went on vacation to Brittany in northwest France, and beautiful area. And we stayed on this island called Belle-Île, and I mean, beautiful nature there. So we go down to the beach first day. I'm thinking this is a fantastic beach. Not many people around. The whole family and their relatives took all their clothes off, every single piece. And so I'm like, oh my gosh. I talk about way out your depth, you know. So what it meant, I didn't know where to look. So what it meant was suddenly life on Earth became really fascinating. I read that book like from cover to cover several times over. So it's sort of because it's a beautiful memory and a somewhat traumatic memory as well. You know, I wanted to be close to nature, but not that close, right? It was a little bit too much for me. In fact, where's J Charles? Oh, sorry, Charles is French. And the first time I went over his house, I was really worried. I was no, nothing untoward happened until then. Anyway, so you know, with my connection to this book, I learned about evolution. Right, that was. I mean, I sort of studied it a little bit at school. I mean, it's a book about evolution. That's not all it's about. And you know, I was brought up to believe that evolution's a lie. It's not true. I don't believe that now. But what I felt reading this book was just this incredible sense of love for God, of love for nature, but love for God. This was a story about origins, and that we all belong to one another. We're all connected to one another. We're all part of nature. We're not separate from it. And it really resonated with what my experience had been, or you know, at the ripe old age of 12 or 13, whatever I was. So it was very impactful to me. It made me love God even more. It didn't feel threatening at all. And I guess that's the place I found myself spiritually in many respects, because like when we think about nature, perhaps nature really is fundamental to our identity as humans, fundamental to our spirituality in a way that we've somehow become more removed from now. Certainly, as we've developed as the human race, we've become. It seems like development means almost a bigger separation from nature rather than a connection to it. I mean, we connect to it recreationally, but most of us are quite removed from it in terms of survival, production of food, et cetera, et cetera. And so perhaps that disconnection hasn't really helped us spiritually. And maybe likewise, when we think about religion, faith, spirituality, separation from nature might be a problem. If you think about it this way, when we think about the sort of basic human identity, at some point humanity became conscious, right? And if, I mean, most scientists would say humans have been around 100,000 years or so, right? So at some point we became conscious. I mean, that's this incredible gift where we wake up in the middle of the night and we think, how the heck did we get here? And where have we come from? Where are we going to? And wow, look at that sunset, or I need to eat that animal, or I need to eat those vegetables, et cetera, et cetera. Consciousness, awareness. And then we become aware of what we would call divinity. And, you know, that's probably, you know, from archaeology and anthropology, we know that was fairly primitive at first. But we have things like death that we struggle with, and birth that seems so beautiful, and crops that fail and crops that don't fail, and earthquakes and different things like this, that where we're like filled with a sense of awe and wonder. And then we develop language where we're able to communicate with one another about that, to talk about it, process it. And we are able to tell stories that are kind of faith stories in a way, stories about our identity, our existence, our belonging. And then eventually we develop writing, right? So we actually write those stories down. And then we have literature, and then we have sacred scripture. So really, sacred scripture, if you think about something like the Bible, for instance, is quite a latecomer in terms of the spirituality of humanity. Not saying this, that makes it, you know, below par or anything like that. It's just like, if we think about how to experience God as humans, and we're going to narrow it down to a sacred text, this one or that one or the other one, that would seem quite a narrow way that's only been available to humanity for a very, very small fraction of time relative to all of our existence. You know, the Bible, most of the oldest writings in the Bible are 2,700 years old, at the most, probably. Certainly in terms of when you think about not just the original writings, but our accessibility to things like the Bible, you know, the Bible didn't get translated into the vernacular, different languages other than the original language and then Latin, until 500 years ago or so. And then you'd be pretty pressed to get a copy, because, you know, the printing press had to be invented to get, you know, copies circulated. So the likes of you and me would not have access to a Bible until relatively recently in human history. And now, of course, we have all the different copies, different versions, different tools to help us interpret it. And it's wonderful, fantastic. But somehow nature is perhaps in some ways more fundamental, more, you probably shouldn't use that word when you're talking about religion, but I think you know what I mean. There's something really, really natural about it, surprisingly. That said, let's look at a few scriptures, right, after having said all that, because I think the Bible itself gets at this. The Bible itself seems to present to us nature as something divine, as something spiritual. The Psalms, so in the Hebrew scripture, it says, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it, the world and all who live in it. You get that sense of oneness, that we're all part of it and it's part of us. Jesus, think about Jesus. Let's move on to the next scripture. So this is Jesus right at the beginning of his ministry. He says this: at once the Spirit sent him out into the wilderness, the wild place. And he was in the wilderness 40 days, being tempted by Satan. He was with the wild animals, and angels attended him. So in the discussion questions this week, there's a question about this passage saying, you know, why would the Spirit send Jesus into the wilderness? Why did Jesus willingly, apparently, go into the wilderness? And it's, you know, that's a discussion. There's no one answer to that. But the point being here, like, I don't know whether you've thought about this. Jesus spent a lot of time outdoors, right? I mean, he was occasionally in a house, occasionally in a synagogue. He'd go to the temple. We have stories of that. Obviously, you know, in most of the Gospels, he really only goes there once. But he spends a lot of time outdoors. It's almost as if Jesus is taking people away from this religion that has perhaps become separated from nature and gets people out there. And he himself goes out there. He's having this deep experience. in the wilderness. The implication here is that he's been tempted, or not implication, statement is he's been tempted by Satan, the accuser. But you get this sense that God's with him. That's this spiritual process taking place in Jesus. And of course, Jesus comes out of the wilderness and starts teaching on the mountainside, in the fields. Let's go to the next one. And he even uses many, many times natural metaphors to talk about God. Here's one we quote many times here at Cedar Ridge. Therefore, I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more than food and the body more than clothes? Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow or reap or store away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than they? Can any one of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your life? And why do you worry about clothes? See how the flowers of the field grow. They do not labor or spin. Yet I tell you that not even Solomon, in all his splendor, was dressed like one of these. If that is how God clothes the grass of the field, which is here today and tomorrow is thrown into the fire, will he not much more clothe you, you of little faith? And that ending there, you of little faith, I think often gets interpreted as disparaging. It's like, you've got such little faith. But actually, in the original language, it could be translated, when you look at that original language, faithling, ones with little faith or little faith people. In other words, it's more of a diminutive. It's more perhaps an affectionate term, like Jesus is saying, if only you knew, if only you knew how loved you are and how connected to God you are and how present to God, to you God is, how much God longs for you. If only you knew. It has a tenderness to it, I think, rather than a sense of judgment. So Jesus is pointing to the natural world to say, his evidence of God, or his evidence of God's love. Consider the flowers, consider the birds. In Luke's account of this kind of passage, the author talks about sparrows. If, you know, like God knows when a sparrow falls, and if God knows that, then God loves you. So these are metaphors, okay? Metaphors are for God and about God, but Jesus is pointing to the natural world. So let's look at the natural world. I want to start off with a little video from Instagram. It's this new thing that's come out that, you know, you can share all sorts of things on. I'm not on social media, so it's kind of a bit of a mystery to me. That sounds really old fashioned. But anyway, let's look. Maybe we can pause it, Greg, just a second. So that's perfect. So this is a group of people who are on safari. I'm not exactly sure where. It's in Africa, but not exactly sure where. And they're looking, hoping to see lions. And this lion's, okay, we can, this lioness comes around the corner. Let's just watch it. There's a guide on the front of the truck when we go forward a bit. There's the guide. They're intently looking. Where have all the lions gone? And watch this guy's reaction here. It's all in slow motion, but look, he grabs onto something. And they meet, they gaze at one another. And then I'm not too bothered, really. She's going to move off. Okay, so what can we conclude from this? Well, a couple of things, I think. One is nature's watching us, right? We may want to watch nature or look at nature, but again, that oneness thing, nature's looking at us. If you go for a walk in the woods, it's all eyes on you. It's like, let's get away, let's hide. I don't know whether you've ever been on a walk and I've had this actually with owls where, you know, you'd be walking along and then you just turn and there's an owl and it's just staring at you. And it's probably been staring at you for goodness knows how long, but you didn't notice that it was there. Nature's watching us. We're part of it as much as we're observing it. And then the other thing is on this one is like, I longed and still do to some degree to go to the Serengeti, to go on safari and see exotic wildlife. But actually, there's so much beauty, so much of this natural awe and wonder around us wherever we are. And so I want to show some pictures that I've taken mostly on a pretty crummy old iPhone, but pictures that I've taken in a place that we all have in common, which is here, our Cedar Ridge property. So we're just going to look at those to look at when we look closely or when we look with awareness, the kind of beauty that we can see. Now, let's start off with some trees. So common tree, right? Eastern redbud, beautiful tree. This is one of the ones that we have on our property out. But if you go over to the parking lot over there and then sort of walk down toward the side of the solar field. I mean, I think these just are incredibly beautiful trees, but this time of year, especially when they're blossoming or the blossoms kind of towards the end now, I think we've just taken so much for granted. Here's some close-ups I took early on. The blossoms come out of the bark. You know, I mean, it's just no leaves, no stalks. These things just grow out of the bark on the twigs. And we'll keep going through these, Greg. And then they grow a little bit more luscious, obviously. And then we get these beautiful blooms. This is all from that same tree by the time at the height of the spring. So just beautiful trees. This is, I think, my favorite tree on the property, the next one. This is out on the parking lot, just over there in the parking lot. You may have parked under it sometimes. It's a Carolina Silverbell. So you can see the blossoms on that. They've gone now. So I'm going to show you some pictures of blossoms and flowers that have gone, just so you know, for next year, if you go out into the woods, you might see them. These are the blossoms on the Silverbell. You can see why it's called a Silverbell. It's sort of bell-shaped. That tree was just full of these blossoms. And then it's like it's snowing underneath because, you know, when they start falling, it's incredible. This is black cherry. So these are out now. The black cherries are blossoming. So we have some amazing trees on our property. You just walk around and look at them and take note of them. And then we've got some really amazing flowers. So if you go into the woods in the spring, what are called spring ephemerals, meaning transient flowers, they come out sort of toward the end of February, March, and then they're usually gone by. Usually by May. These are anemones. They're called rue anemones. They have these beautiful little leaves. I think we'll keep going, Greg. See the shape of these leaves, just really delicate, beautiful things. And they cover the woodland floor. If you go into the next one. Has anybody seen any of these out there in our woods at all? If you've been out there, yeah. Next one is spring beauty. This is, you know, we don't have much spring beauty, but you go into other woodland around here. In April, end of March, April, it's just covered in spring beauty. These are all native wildflowers, so they're natural to this area. Let's keep going, Greg. So this one, this is star chickweed. Now, most people have a fight with chickweed because it's an invasive weed. This is a native star chickweed, really beautiful. Again, you'll see whole areas of the woodland floor covered in this. And then we'll keep going. This is cut-leaf toothwort. It's not really very open there, but it's another beautiful one. That's called dwarf ginseng, a really lovely flower. Again, spreads out, and then you've got these like five. It's got five leaves, as you can see there, which are just very pretty. It's not a great photo, but I've got the flower in focus there. This is hepatica, or also called liverwort, beautiful little flowers. You can see beautiful. We'll go back a bit. Beautiful shaped leaves as well. All these are on in our woodland. Violets, next one. And, you know, there's a ton of those. Keep going. We'll just keep scrolling through these. And then on to the next one. This one is called, has anybody seen this flower before at all? Yeah, this is called a yellow trout lily. It's called yellow because it's yellow. But then on the next one, I've got another one. It looks a bit like a lily, right? And then these are its leaves. Again, not really in focus, but that people thought looked like trouts. So the yellow trout lily. Beautiful, beautiful little flower. And then we'll keep going into our meadow. Those are natural native plants. We have a meadow out as you drive in. It's on the left-hand side, which we've specifically set aside for intentional growing of native wildflowers. So we planted a bunch there. Originally, it was a research project with the University of Maryland, which is now finished, but we still maintain it as a wildflower meadow, and we want to perhaps extend it. So this is what it looks like. Well, that's what it looks like a few weeks ago. And then we scrape all the dead grass off the top to allow the wildflowers to come back through. And then in a few months, it will look like this. There's some growth in there already. You can scroll through these, Greg. That's bee balm. It's so luscious when you think of what it was, just a few weeks ago. Just a really beautiful meadow. So I encourage you, go out and walk around that meadow. It's very accessible. We can keep going. So we've got things like in there, like these are black-eyed Susans. You've obviously very well-known plant. Keep going. This is called blue vervain. Really beautiful plant. Insects love it. Keep going. Coreopsis. And this is swamp milkweed. So it's different to the usual milkweed we get out in our meadows. We deliberately sowed this swamp milkweed. Really lovely, beautiful flower. And the insects love them. So there's one of our honeybees on the blue vervain. And they're to attract pollinators. That's part of the intention of all this, to attract the pollinators. So honeybees aren't native, they're to the US. But this is the carpenter bee. So we get a lot of the native pollinators out on these flowers. And then keep going. This is a bit like showing somebody your holiday snaps, isn't it? And you're sat there thinking, not another one of the flower. Oh, gosh. We'll get through the flower in a minute. This is a swallowtail, tiger swallowtail butterfly on the bee balm. They called it bee balm because it's easier than calling it tiger swallowtail balm. And then this, does anyone know what that is? That's a tiger swallowtail caterpillar. So you look at that and then look at the butterfly. Anybody can believe in hope and transformation, right? If that can happen. So thanks, Greg. Let's keep going. This is a clear wing, sometimes known as a hummingbird moth. I don't know if you've ever seen those really weird moths that look like hummingbirds, sort of mimic hummingbirds. Very, very strange insects. This one, I didn't take this one. I took all of those other ones, but I did not take this one. This is a blue dasher dragonfly. I think dragonflies are perhaps my favorite insect. I mean, does anything else in the natural world look as much like a fairy as a dragonfly? When you look at that, there's sort of a humanoid aspect to them. They're just incredible. And they eat mosquitoes, like a ton of them. So if you've got them in your yard, it's great because they'll just keep eliminating the mosquitoes. So dragonflies are great. And there's always so many different kinds. So let's talk about the birds, right? So I remember when I came to, what's this bird? Anybody? Kind of everybody knows a cardinal, right? They're so common all year round. But when I came to US for the first time, I was like, look at the color of that bird. Like, we just don't have birds in England that are as red as that. We have lots of really beautiful birds, but it's just striking. But it's so easy, I think, to get used to the cardinal. But what an incredible looking bird. And then the beauty there. We have indigo buntings. That's not a fantastic picture, but so blue. They're back now. So I saw one in our yard yesterday. So they fly south for winter. They're back. Beautiful song, beautiful looking birds, indigo bunting. And then the American goldfinch, of course. So we have these colors, this vibrancy that is all around us, which I think is so easy to take for granted. Okay, let's look at some more birds from our property. Okay, all those are on our property. Great horned owl. We have great horned owls. Again, I didn't take this picture. It's easy to take a picture of a flower, right? They don't move. But by the time, I mean, it's hard to catch these things in your binoculars, let alone on film. So I'm going to show you birds up here. A ton more, but a few that we have. This is an eastern screech owl. This is a barred owl. Beautiful birds. Again, all on our property. We get bald eagles. We get osprey. So they're the more sort of exotic, if you like, type birds. But we have these beautiful birds called cedar waxwings. They have these little yellow tips at the on their tails. Anybody know what this one's called? I think this is my favorite name for a bird. This is a bobolink. They're called bobolinks. It's just, I don't know why they call it, but we get flocks of those coming through. What's that one? Yeah, that's a Baltimore Oriole. We get those. But we also get more of these ones, orchard orioles. Beautiful color, beautiful song again. We'll keep going, Greg. And we have a load of woodpeckers, right? This is a downy woodpecker. Sorry, this is a downy woodpecker. This is a hairy woodpecker. This is a red-bellied woodpecker. This is a yellow-bellied sapsucker, which is a woodpecker. This is a pileated woodpecker. And then this is a northern flicker. That doesn't really look like a woodpecker, but it is a woodpecker. And they're usually on the ground, they're ground feeders, which is unusual for woodpeckers. So there's not just woodpeckers, there's all kinds of woodpeckers, just like there's not just sparrows, there's all kinds of sparrows. So we have, this is a chipping sparrow. This is a song sparrow. This is a field sparrow. And this is a white-throated sparrow. And there's a ton of other sparrows. Again, we get all these on our property. So when somebody says his eye is on the sparrow, I kind of think, which sparrow? I'm not joking. I'm not trying to make a joke. What I mean is, like, oh, it's a sparrow. Oh, it's a woodpecker. I mean, that's yes, true, and it's okay. But perhaps his eye is on the sparrow. That's a metaphor for how God interacts with us. It's maybe God sees Matthew and Charles, and he sees the uniqueness of us, the detail of us, the difference in us. Maybe God sees us that way. And the different way we sound. So I don't know, I think we've got some sound files here. So these, okay, so that's, we'll just hold that one over. So that's the chipping sparrow. If you walk out to the parking lot on this side, or yeah, this side, it's full of chipping sparrows. You'll hear this all the time. Let's hear it again. Chipping sparrow. Yeah, I'll do that all day long. The song sparrow, beautiful. They've got different sounds. They, you know, different languages. And the field sparrow, this is a good one. Oh. Okay, that's not, it doesn't come out quite as distinctively there, but that's known as a, or described as a ping pong ball, just going like, it's sort of, you know, that's how that, how you identify the sound of a field sparrow. Anyway, and then the white-throated sparrow. You hear that all through the winter. Beautiful song. So there's a difference. There's when we look and we look intently and we look awarely, we see a difference in all these birds. It's not just a sparrow, right? I'm not just Matthew. You're not just Sarah. We're unique. We're beautiful. We're part of this uniqueness. Let's move on. We're nearly done here. Don't worry. So this is the top of the evolutionary pile. Okay. So this is my dog Baron. We go out on the property quite a lot. But we have foxes, gray and red foxes, possums, coyotes. He ran into a coyote just a few weeks ago down in the woods. He thought it was a game, but the coyote didn't. So I had to put him on his leash and get him out of there. So, you know, lots of groundhogs, of course, and God loves groundhogs, even though we try to keep them out of our buildings. And sometimes he'll help me find wildlife. So there, I don't even see the little fawn there, who I think had just been born, because we've got a closer look there. You can see still very wet, but the deer will leave their baby in the long grass. That's part of the advantage of having the meadows that we have. How can you not just love a little fawn like that? It's just so beautiful, so precious. And Baron also likes to observe wildlife. Moving on to the next one, or observe nature. Next slide. There's a double rainbow out on our property. We get all kinds of incredible weather formations, all kinds of. I come out here sometimes when there's a storm, because you have a huge horizon here, really great cloud formations, weird kind of wind just because there's space. Well, this is the last picture, you'll be glad to know. I don't know whether you can see this. I was taking a picture of this. This is from about 4 years ago because of the clouds. I was just trying to capture some clouds. I don't know if it shows up. If you're at the front, maybe. Do you see this? There's a line there. I think it's a tornado. I think. My kids said they think it's a drip on my lens, you know, that's rolling down. But I'm thinking, I don't think it is, because you look at the lens, it would just blur out the whole thing. So I think it's probably just a little tornado effect that I didn't see at the time, but saw after when I was looking at the photos. It's either that or it might be aliens landing. That was the other thing I thought, you know, how they sort of get beamed into, forget what movie that is, and they live underground until they're ready to come out. But so maybe one day we'll find out that's what it was. I don't know whether you like stargazing. This again, beautiful horizons here. So great place to look at stars, beautiful sunsets. And this is just Spencerville, right? It's just in Spencerville. And there's many other places around here where we can experience this. So just want to encourage you to get out and experience nature. You know, this place is open to you 24/7 to explore. And there's some really wonderful, beautiful things to be seen. Let's just close out here. Maybe Ben can come up and we'll sing our last song together. But we'll just close out here with some thoughts. Maybe when we think about God being distant, and let's face it, we all feel that at times, don't we? In fact, we might feel that. That might be more our experience than the other. So we might spend more time feeling God as distant or absent than actually present. But perhaps nature is divine presence. You know, when we say something like, his eye is on the sparrow, we're using language there, very human language. We know God's not a man, so we say his, but we just trying to find language that transcends, or we're trying to find language that actually is incapable of transcending meaning. You know, our language just isn't enough. But when we're out in nature, we can feel it, we can experience it, we can absorb it, we can immerse ourselves in it. So here's just a few things that to leave us with, ways that we can experience divine presence through nature would be beauty, right? I think of beauty as being, beauty and awe are very similar, I think. They're connected in some way. But when I think of beauty, and this is just very subjective, I think of it as a very imminent thing. It's a very concrete thing, a real thing. Oh, that is beautiful. That yellow trout lily is so beautiful. And that somehow leads to love, I think, or it leads to an experience of love. Whereas awe is more transcendent, I think. It's when we see something, perhaps we see a whole field of yellow trout lilies, or, you know, a woodland floor. Or we see a murmuration of starlings and it's just mesmeric. Or we see a constellation, or we see the eclipse of the sun. It's transcendent. It takes us almost into another world. It's less concrete, it's more whole. So we can have these experiences, which I think are spiritual experiences through nature. Nature can make us more aware. I mean, part of why I like to identify things, to name birds, name flowers, firstly, it's because I'm obsessive. That's part of it, actually. But also because it helps me focus. Because if you need to name something, you have to really look at it closely. And I get distracted very easily, and I get very anxious and very preoccupied with my own world and my own problems. And observing something closely and seeing its beauty and being able to identify it makes me more aware, makes me more conscious in the present moment. You know, for awareness, we would use terms like mindfulness, wouldn't we, or consciousness, intentionality. It helps me do that. Just yesterday, I was having not a great day. And I came out here, went onto the property with my wife and the dog, and I started observing things. And it just took me to a different place. Connection, this sense that we belong to nature, nature belongs to us. We belong to God, God belongs to us, that we're part of something beautiful, part of something way bigger than us. We belong, we're significant. And then finally, grounding, this sense of being grounded in the present moment. But I think also this is what Jesus is getting at when he says, look at the lilies of the field, look at the birds of the air. They're here today and they're gone tomorrow, but they're still important. And I think sometimes we need to be grounded that way by, like, we're not necessarily the most important thing in the universe. And some of the things that I worry about aren't necessarily the most important thing in the universe. And nature just is, right? Nature, I mean, there's lots of stuff going on in nature, but it's like, nature, there's birth, there's death, and then there's resurrection, right? Because spring will come. Nature just is. It's not worrying. And that's one of the problems of consciousness, obviously, is it can be a beautiful thing, but it can be something that makes us worry. Whereas if we were able to just see ourselves as part of this, that it's okay. It's okay. We can be. We can, perhaps being is another way of talking about spirituality or talking about God or talking about ourselves. We can just be. We don't have to struggle with every single thing that comes our way. We can just be. We can let things go. We can kind of rest into the rhythm that nature finds, that we find so hard to find. So I don't know whether any of these are helpful. Thank you for being patient with me, showing you my photos. And let's sing this last song together, and then we'll close out our service. Let's stand.